Before Shemoneh Esrei, we daven to be able to daven. Right? Shemoneh Esrei starts with the words Hashem Sefasai Tiftach Ufi Yagiti Lasecha. God, please open up my mouth and let my mouth say your praises. Obviously, it's very, very difficult to daven. If we start off davening by davening that we should be able to daven, then obviously it's a very difficult thing to do. We need to pray. We need to start off by saying, I don't think I can really do this. And I need your help if I'm going to do this. So before we start, we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu for assistance, which we'll ask from him as we go through this class. But even though we're asking for his assistance, we really need to focus on our tefillahs if we're going to succeed with them. Now, at one point, the Gemara seems to say tefillah was in its proper place. The Gemara says that the early rabbis, the Hasidim HaRishonim, it's a famous Gemara, the Hasidim Rishonim, used to wait for an hour before they started to daven. Then they would daven for an hour, even Ma'ariv, and then they would think about it for an hour, how they did. So the Gemara does a little bit of quick math and says 9 hours a day. It took them 3 hours. It took an hour to get into it, an hour to daven, an hour to get out of it. So obviously they didn't have a mincha ma'ariv like we have today. 9 hours a day they're spending in tefillah. When do they do anything else? But already the Gemara, a few daf earlier in the Gemara in Brachos, already says that dvarim, there are dvarim ha'omdim berumo shel olam u'bnei adam mezalzalin b'hem. There are certain things that are the most important things in the whole world, and yet people don't take them very seriously. And one of the things on that list is tefillah. Tefillah. It seems that there were once people who did understand how important tefillah was, but they were the Hasidim Rishonim. Hasidim, not like today we have Hasidim. Everybody, a lot of Hasidim today. Hasidim Rishonim means they were really, really pious people who used to know how to daven. And very interestingly, they chose to daven 9 hours a day. That means it must have cut very much into their mitzvos, to their learning. There were people who understood at one point that it's kedai to daven for 9 hours a day. But for most people, even at the time of the Gemara, davening was something that's really, really important that people just really don't take seriously. But we can't give up. In the Sefer Ali Shor, sort of Wobi points out that most of our religious life is based in tefillah. Now he used the word religious here, he doesn't say observant life, mitzvah life. Most of our religious life, in other words, the extent that we have any ruchnias, is based in tefillah. Tefillah is not just another mitzvah, as we're going to see and we're going to learn. It's the key to our entire belief in Hashem. If you look at tefillah svarim, Tefillah Svarim ultimately, as this class is going to do, quickly veer off the subject of tefillah, because tefillah is not just another mitzvah. It basically says what we believe in about God. It's all the fundamentals of what we believe about God. If you look at the Balei Machshava, the Balei Hashkafa, right? Everybody today is into Rav Pinkus, right? We'll talk a little bit about Rav Pinkus. Everybody today has got to read Rav Pinkus. It's very hard to understand what Rav Pinkus is really saying. But Rav Pinkus in his life wrote two svarim that we have, really two svarim. He wrote a sefer on tefillah and he wrote a sefer on Shabbos. There's a rav in Beit Vegan. His name is Rakovsky, Ehud Rakovsky. Most of you have never heard the name, never will, unless his stuff gets translated by Art Scroll. Then everybody will hear of this guy. He lives in Beit Vegan. He is the basis for much of what we're going to learn for the next number of weeks. He wrote two svarim that are out there on Hashkafa. Two svarim in Hashkafa. One on tefillah and one on Shabbos. We're not going to get to discuss Shabbos this semester, next semester either. A little bit. We're going to talk a little bit. We're going to read a little bit from his sefer on Shabbos. But somehow, what we think and what we believe, what we do about tefillah, is the basis of everything. Everything. This is really a Hashkafa class. But it gets, you get to exercise that. You get to examine that through the lens of tefillah. So we can't just be okay at tefillah. That's the premise of this class. We can't, you know, Judaism is very difficult. You got to be good at a lot of things to be a good Jew. You got to specialize in a lot of areas. You got to be basically a GP. You got to be a general practitioner. You got to know how to do this well and that well, and you got to have a little ruchnius and a little intellect. You got to learn a little Torah. You got to do mitzvahs. You got to be kind. You got to do a lot of stuff. And not everybody's good at everything. But tefillah is not one of those things that we could not be so good at. It just isn't. It's just one of the most important things, and we don't feel that way. At least not emotionally. We don't really feel that way, and we don't see that people treat it that way. But the reality is that tefillah is more than other things. Tefillah is more important. Tefillah is the root of many, many things. And that's why the first words we have, Hashem Sfasai Tiftach, open up my lips, allow us to pray. But it's very, very difficult. It's very, very difficult also to give a shir on a Yanei Tefillah. First of all, it's very difficult to make a tefillah shir practical. Right? I don't want to just stay up in the air and this and that, but I also don't want to sit and have a workshop where everybody stands up and concentrates for 3 minutes, and I've seen that too. And maybe that works for some of you. I always thought that was a little hokey. Very difficult to make tefillah practical. We're not going to do Hilchos Tefillah, and unless we understand Hilchos Tefillah, Hilchos Tefillah in and of itself, if you don't have any idea why we do these things, doesn't help that much with what tefillah is. Another problem is that, as always, and this is going to be a problem with this class, you're going to hear a lot of stuff, and it's very difficult to put it into practice. I can tell you the worst thing, the thing that will ruin your kavana more than anything in tefillah, is thinking about having kavana while you're davening. You can't do both. You really can't. Rav Pinkus, in his Sha'arim BaTefillah, writes that if you want to succeed in tefillah, the key thing you have to do is set times other than tefillah to think about and to work on tefillah. You can't do it b'shas ma'isa. You got to get up and you got to do it. Right? A person who's in a play can't practice their acting while they're on stage. You have to make other times to practice, but when you're up there, you just got to do it. And in fact, if you're thinking too much, you're not going to do it very well. I know that when I was developing the shirim, that was the biggest problem that was happening, because I would think about things as I was davening, and I would get totally lost in my davening, thinking about davening, about what I was saying. Very difficult thing. It's very difficult to make a class like this practical. There's also a certain unspoken assumption that the person who is giving a tefillah shir is obviously very good at davening. And I don't want to make any claims to that. I have my good days, and I have my bad days, like everybody in this room. All I can tell you is that the stuff that I'm really excited to share with you is stuff that has very much changed the way I daven when I daven well. Right? We all have those days. Maybe you don't. I don't know. Women are generally a little better at this than men. But I would venture to say we all have those days where we just daven a Shmon Esrei and it's just a total wipeout. I mean, we don't even remember where we are in it. We finished. We didn't know how we got there through there so fast. But at least the times when I am davening okay, I could say it's much better than I used to be because I have some understanding of what I'm trying to do. So my suggestion to you would be as follows. First of all, try to make time to think about, to collect your thoughts about some of the things we're going to say when you're not davening, outside of the time of davening. Number two, if you're davening mincha, as some women are wont to do, and you can daven it after this shir, that's good. You'll probably daven a lot better after learning these inyanim of tefillah than before, sometime soon thereafter. And the last thing I would suggest is to choose an aspect of tefillah to work on. We can't get everything right at the same time. To daven well is to combine a lot of things. You can only get one thing right at a time. I don't know if any of you have taken speaking classes, but if you're working on your public speaking is a lot of different things, right? Your eye contact, your voice control, your hand movements, all these kinds of things. You can't work on all of them at the same time. If you ever want to improve your speaking, what you have to do is you have to pick one thing I'm going to work on. Now I'm going to work on eye contact. Okay, that's what I'm working on now. Now you have to work on eye contact, right? And you got to just try to figure out if you're getting that right. You can't work on everything in tefillah. You can't do it with tefillah either. You can't get everything right at the same time. You have to pick something. Pick something you're going to work on. Something you're going to think about. And go with that. And when you have that better, go on to something else. We're going to learn many different aspects of tefillah. And my only goal is to try to give each one of you one way of reaching HaKadosh Baruch Hu that you perhaps didn't think about before. We're going to talk about a lot of different ways and different things that are going to strike different people. And the idea is that you find something. You know, there's a minig, there's actually a minig, to shuckle, right? To shuckle when a person is davening. Men do it a little more, women seem to do it a little less. But there's this thing that when I'm davening, I'm supposed to be doing it. Most people don't even realize it anymore. They're just shuckling back and forth. And there are a lot of different reasons why this might be. Some defend it based on the concept of kol atzmosai tomayna. My limbs are supposed to serve God. So not only am I saying, talking about God, but I'm even, my whole body is trying to get to Him. Some people say it's like trembling. It doesn't exactly look like trembling, but it's some kind of trembling. The Sefer HaKuzari says the whole thing is a mistake. You know what the problem was? The problem was people used to, they got it from learning. And the lighting wasn't so good. So whenever they would have to read the next sentence, they'd have to bend down and read the next sentence and then they'd get back up because they'd have to look very closely. So the whole thing is a joke, he says. The Shalah and others say you're not supposed to shake. The more Nisnagdisha groups, there are those who say you're not supposed to shake. You look like an idiot. Some people really do look ridiculous. I'm not saying that they're not doing the right thing. But we've all seen people davening that looked ridiculous. Like, you would stand in front of the king this way? You would stand in front of the king shaking wildly? The Gemara says that Rabbi Akiva used to start on one side of the room. By the time he was done with Shemoneh Esrei, he ended up on the other side of the room. Baal Shem Tov explained that if you were drowning in the water, you'd be flailing your arms pretty wildly, right? You wouldn't just be standing there still. If the life of your entire family were on the line, you wouldn't just be standing pleading calmly with the king. I have a different suggestion. This is what I try to do. It's a suggestion given by Rav Dov Baer, who's the Maggid of Mezrich. I don't know much about him, I'll admit. But I know this comes from Dov Baer. And he says like this. You have to start by shuckling. And then, once you're locked in, then you stop. Think of it as a radio dial. Right? In the good old days, before the radio dials were digitized. Anybody still use an actual radio that you don't... It's actually an actual dial. You're going back and forth. And we all know that thing that you're kind of trying to focus in on that station and you go one way and you go the other way and then you finally hit on the best spot. That's what he suggests. Shuckling is trying to find a frequency. Start by shuckling. You have to kind of get yourself into it a little bit. Find a way to get to God. Find something. Make tefillah real. Find some path to God. And then stand still. Then leave it alone. We're going to look for such an idea in the next couple of weeks. We're going to look for some way to get to God. Something. Some way to make the experience something that's meaningful and worthwhile. And we're going to have to do a lot of back and forth. And I think that one of the things that I like about this is that there's no one way for everybody. We're all different. I'm going to make certain suggestions, but it's going to have to be something that speaks to you. Now that all sounds very up in the air. So let me try to bring things down now a lot more. I want to tell you a story. And this is a true story. It's a true story that resonates a little more with people above the age of 40, but hopefully you'll appreciate it as well. The story takes place, that Mamash Tusar happened to me when I was a kid, the story took place in 1976. It's an October night in 1976. And I find myself, I'm not going to say exactly how old I was at the time, but let's say I was quite a bit shorter than I was now, a little kid in elementary school in Yeshiva. And there I was in this cool October night at Yankee Stadium. Now, my family is pretty staunch Yankee territory. My mother teaches in a city college, which is right across the street from the stadium. Hostos Community College. You ever see on one of the roads there, they have a big sign. So she teaches there. So we always used to get Yankee tickets as kids. We always used to come up with, I mean, really, tickets to things you shouldn't have. And there we were, it was October, it was the fifth and deciding game of the playoffs. That's the days when the playoffs used to be just one thing, and then the World Series, five games, that was it. The Yankees had not been in the playoffs in my lifetime. My lifetime was not very long, but it had been quite a while, I understand, since the 60s or something, since the Yankees really made it into the playoffs. Here they are, the 2-2 games. This is the fifth and deciding game against the Royals, who used to be a half-decent team. And Yankees are winning 6-3. I was a little kid, but I remember this like it was yesterday. Yankees are winning 6-3, going into the top of the eighth inning. And we're all getting ready, and people are, you know, if anyone has ever been in New York, in Yankee Stadium, as they get closer to these things, that people go berserk. Right? The last few years I've been trying to wean my family off of it because it's really a mishikas what goes on. But the stadium goes pretty nuts. So everyone's getting ready. This is it. They're going to go to the World Series. George Brett. Anybody ever hear of George Brett?
Yeah.
Oh, one. Thank you. George Brett gets up. He hits a 3-run homer to tie the score. To tie the score in the eighth inning. Goes to the bottom of the ninth. And there we are. We are very high up. I mean, these are free tickets. We are very, very high up. We are very close to Shemayim. It's like, Mamish, we could reach out and touch him up there. So Chris Chambliss is in the batter's box. Now, this is for anyone who does know Yankee history. This is one of the most famous moments in Yankee history. You just don't know the real story behind it. Chris Chambliss is there in the batter's box, and he's taking his swings before the thing, and everyone is so tense, you could cut it through a knife. 6-6, bottom of the ninth inning. Everybody's looking at Chris Chambliss, and I'm looking up. I look up, and I'm going. My father looks at me and says, Mark, what are you doing? And I said, I'm praying to Hashem that Chris Chambliss should hit a home run. Okay, that's what's important to a kid in third grade, second grade, whatever it is. I'm praying to Hashem. He said, what? I said, I'm praying to Hashem that Chris Chambliss should hit a home run. Chris Chambliss gets into the steps up to the plate, gets up there. First pitch, he hits a home run. Mamish, hits a home run. First pitch, he hits the ball over. He gets the crack of the bat. It wasn't exactly clear what was going to happen. It wasn't like one of these out of the park things. All I know is everybody stands up. I don't see anything, and I'm just like jumping on the rail to try to see anything else going on. And I see, and the guy. It was really a dramatic moment. If anybody knows Yankee history, not that it's terribly important, but this was one of the biggest moments in Yankee history. And he hit a home run on the first pitch. And everybody, the whole stadium erupts. They're going berserk. I'm trying to figure out what's going on. I realize in a second he must have hit the home run. Everybody's screaming and screaming, we're number one, we're number one. And I'm saying, I did it. I did it. I won the world. I won the championship for the New York Yankees. I was so excited to go to school the next day. You can't imagine how early I got up the next morning to tell all of my friends, this is a true story, that I actually won the championship for the New York Yankees. There were 60,000 people there. They're all screaming number one. And I'm saying, thank you. Thanks a lot. That really worked. That is a true story. And that's actually the reason why the Yankees won the championship. I didn't get a single ticket for the World Series. And they lost 4-0 to the Reds. 4 games in and out. Nothing to talk about. Should have had this little kid up there. Now that is, I promise, a true story, and it's a very childish story. It's a very childish view of tefillah, but it's a very mature view of tefillah also, because that was one of the few times where I actually davened to Hashem, and I had a sense that He listened to me. Now, I don't really think, as a mature adult, that the Yankees are really important enough for him to meddle in. I'm not going to discuss whether or not it's a proper tefillah to pray for the Yankees, or certainly to pray for the Mets, to say Mishaberos, or whatever you're going to say. As I've grown older, I've grown further away from sports, and I've grown, I think, to appreciate that certainly it doesn't necessarily have a place in our Shmona Esrei's. That these teams, whatever happens, it's nice, it's fun, whatever it is. But I felt that one night that I had spoken to God and that God had listened to me. And that's what tefillah is really all about. That's what tefillah is really all about. You know, schools today are starting to teach more about tefillah. And I know my kids have units on tefillah, and my daughter comes home from elementary school, and she really knows what many of the words mean. But there's one fundamental aspect to tefillah that is just never discussed in school. And that is that when I'm davening, I'm talking to God. He's listening to me. And He can change anything because I asked Him to. That's funny. Like, you can't, I don't know why that gets missed in second grade, but you can't really talk to second graders about that so much. I mean, you can in an Uncle Moshe sort of way, but it kind of gets lost in the shuffle. So instead of teaching our kids that davening is talking to God, we teach them what the words mean, and we teach them how to daven. It takes a long time, how to daven. And then we teach them what some of the words mean when they get into 6th or 7th and 8th grade. You can't sit down with a class of high schoolers and say, tefillah is talking to God. I mean, that was like step one. You skipped that years ago. But that is the fundamental idea of tefillah. The idea that it's something real. It's the sense that I'm actually talking to God. Not just being into it. Right? We speak of kavana. What does kavana mean? Right? Speak of kavana, we speak of being into it. We think that person has a lot of kavana. Kavana means direction. It means you have some idea where these tefillos are going. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rabbi Soloveitchik that some are more familiar with, the Rav, his grandfather, he writes in the beginning of his Sefer of the Rambam that there are two kinds of kavana in davening. There's the kavana, which we're all thinking of, which is to know what I'm talking about and to mean it. And then there's a more basic kavana, to simply have some idea that I'm standing in front of God. The reason why he puts this in his Sefer, if you know the way the Briskers learn, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik is always trying to find two Rambams that contradict. The Rambam in one place seems to say that kavana is good. Everybody agrees, good. In another place, the Rambam seems to say that kavana is absolutely essential. It's a joke if you don't have kavana. So he says, what are you talking about? What's going on? So he says, it's two things. To know what the words mean is good. But if you have no idea that you're standing in front of God, if you feel nothing at all, which many of us don't sometimes, then it's a joke. It's not tefillah. You can't get around that. Unless I minimally think I'm talking to God, unless I minimally think I'm standing before the Bore, then there's really nothing at all to talk about. The first level of kavana, the most important level, and we'll get, if please God, the second semester, we'll talk about other kinds of kavana and this and that. We will. But we're going to try to spend a semester and a half, probably, just figuring out the most basic kind of kavana, which means, what does it mean that I'm standing here? You know, I've had some of my best Shmona Esrays at gas stations. I really have. Some of my best Shmona Esrays have been at gas stations. And when I was in college, I used to do a lot of Kiruv works. I used to drive up and down the Jersey Turnpike a lot. I lived in Jersey, whatever, for better or for worse. And I used to drive up and down the Turnpike and the Parkway all the time, and I would. We were involved in a lot of Kiruv. So I used to end up a lot of mincha times at gas stations. You know, I was just on the road, and I didn't have anywhere to stop. So you pull over in one of these, you know, rest stations or whatever it is. So what are you going to do? You're going to stand outside your car. I mean, we've all done this. We've all davened in strange places. So you're going to stand outside your car and just daven. People are looking at you. You're wondering. Your Yetzer Hara says you don't have to daven because it's a chilul Hashem. Because if they see you, they'll think Jews are crazy, so I shouldn't daven at all. That's probably not true. But we all have felt that discomfort of davening in a funny place at a funny time. So what do I do? So I learned this from one of my friends in NCSY at the time. So I go for the nearest phone booth. That's what I do. I head to the nearest phone booth. It's Gevaldik. I make sure the phone booth is free. I take three steps into the phone booth. I pick up the phone. I pretend to dial a number. And I have a 2-3 minute conversation. I put down the phone and I back out. It's a great idea, by the way. If you ever want to look not funny, just go over to a phone booth and have a conversation. Some of the best monasteries I ever davened were on the phone. Because even though it's certainly not recommended to daven in a phone booth, and it's not recommended to daven outside of a shul without a minyan, but at least I felt like I was talking to somebody. The experience of dialing HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as silly as it sounds, I don't set it up, I'm not suggesting you go home and do this, this is if you get stuck on the road, but the experience of dialing HaKadosh Baruch Hu can be a very, very powerful one. Because at least I have the basic idea that I'm having a conversation with somebody. you'll find that when you daven on the phone, you daven much more slowly. You actually break up the sentences into meaningful parts. And not only that, you try to end it with something. You feel that when you're ending it, you've got to end it with something before you put down the phone. That's the most very basic level of tefillah. The question is, how am I supposed to feel this way? I mean, the challenge is that God is invisible. And again, I know I'm using a lot of, I'm not a particularly fluffy, hokey kind of speaker, but you got to discuss some of these things when we talk about tefillah, at least a little bit. The problem is, we don't feel that way because God doesn't look like anything. I mean, if God looked like a king, and we could stand in front of him, we could all daven a lot better. There's no doubt about it. But we're asked to do something really difficult, to close our eyes and imagine we're in front of him. But the problem is, even if we are in front of him, we have no idea what he is. Let me ask you a question. I mean, when you've had that best Shmoneh Esrei you ever had, okay, the best Shmoneh Esrei you ever had where you really felt like you were talking to God, what was he? What did you think you were standing in front of? Don't know. Some people, a fire, an abyss, a sky, or something. I don't know. It's really difficult. We often underestimate, though, how important it is to make this real. The pasuk says, "Karov Hashem l'chol korav, l'chol asher yikruuhu be'emes." God is close to anyone who calls him, to anyone who calls him in truth. What does it mean, who calls him in truth? Be'emes. Should be be'kavana, something. So Rav Chasdai Kreskes, who lived in the 1300s, explain this as follows, and this is the most important thing we're going to do, is that davening has to be truthful, it has to be real. I don't care whether you're intellectual or you're spiritual or you like davening where it's just totally silent or you like a Karl Bach minion or whatever it is. The most important thing of davening is that it be a real experience, that it not be a joke. It's something that we do 1, 2, 3 times a day at least. And that's if you're not counting brachos. We're doing it already. The main thing is not to make it a joke. To make it something real. To make it a conversation of some sort. To realize you're talking to somebody. The Chafetz Chaim has a famous letter that he wrote to some of the students, some of the soldiers who were conscripted by the Russian army, by the Tsar. And he writes so passionately to the soldiers that don't worry if you don't remember the words. Don't worry if you're not able to daven the whole davening. Just realize that you're talking to God. And face Yerushalayim. Interesting other point. Face Yerushalayim, but just know that you're talking to God. But how do we make it real? How are we supposed to make seeing God as something real? So I would suggest the following. The Gemara tells us that we're supposed to daven in a particular order. Okay? When we daven, we're supposed to daven in a particular thing, right? If you look at the source sheet, use the source sheet at least once today, I'm getting a little carried away here. If you look at the source sheet, right, we're just going to use the first couple of lines. By the way, in general, in the source sheets are a bonus. It's not a textual class. For those of you who are better with the sheets, wonderful. If you want to read ahead, you can read it at home. But for those of you who are not as familiar with every single word, don't worry. It's not going to be an impediment to understanding what we're doing. Zarash Reb Simlai. Reb Simlai says as follows. La'olam yasader adam shivcho shalmakom shel hakadosh baruch hu v'achar kach yispalel. A person should first set up their praise of Hashem, and only then should they daven. The Rambam says that what this means is as follows. That when we daven Shmoneh Esrei, we're supposed to do, right? You know there are three parts to Shmoneh Esrei, right? Everybody good on that? Right, we've heard that before. And this is, at least according to the Rambam, what women have to do every day minimally, right? You have to start with Shevach, praise. Then you have to do Bakasha, you have to ask for something. And then you have to do Hodah, then you have to thank him. Okay? That's the formula. You got to start by praising, and then you got to ask him for something, and then you got to thank him. There's a lot of problems with that. What am I thanking for to get anything yet?
We'll get to that. That'll be probably seconds from that until we figure out what in the world we're thanking him for.
It's also interesting to note that the Gemara says, "La'olam yisader adam shivcho shomakom baruchu shalakadosh baruchu va'achar kach yitpalel." Person should say shevach first, and then they should be mitpalel. The Gemara seems to say that tefillah mitpalel is synonymous with which part? Bakasha, which is interesting because so many people are uncomfortable with bakasha. I mean, you know, praising God, thanking God, but that I should ask for my everyday needs. That's like a little funny. The Gemara seems to say that that's what tefillah is, that until you get to the second part of Shemoneh Esrei, you're not even davening. But okay. But la'olam yisader adam shivcho shomacha. A person should put together the praise of God, and then they should start davening. Now, why is that? It's a little strange. I mean, the silly way to think about it is that you need to butter God up before you ask him for stuff. You know, I have all these things I need. So if I, you know, if I say nice things about him, it's more likely that I'll get them. That doesn't make any sense, I hope, to anybody in the room. So then why do we do it?
For our own self, we have to realize who we're talking to.
Right. So one way is to say, in a simple sense, is that I need to treat it as if it was a king. Right? I'm just going to change that, I would say, in two ways. Right? One way is to say, I'm moving from my tape recorder, I forgot it's there. One way is to say that we need to treat it as if it's a king. Now, if this really was a king, this is just a test, but if this were an actual king, then I would never approach him without praising him. So by praising him, I remember that I'm standing in front of somebody important. It's not really for God. It's for me. I go through the motions. You know why I take three steps forward? So I'm supposed to feel like I'm in his presence. I'll tell you all a secret. You're in his presence when you're three steps backwards too. You can't get away from his presence even if you want to. So why am I suddenly in his presence when I take three steps forward? Because when I go to speak to somebody, I go into their office or into their chamber, whatever it is. So I'm doing stuff to pretend to get myself into it. But the Sefer Beis Elokim, Rav Moshe of Trani, in the 1500s, said the following, which may be, Andrew, what you were saying, but he says that the reason why we praise Hashem is not so in general we get a sense of who, before whom we're standing, but so we know exactly before whom we're standing. When we start Shemoneh Esrei with praise, so we are defining for ourselves before whom we're standing. That's the purpose of it. It's so that I know who I'm talking to. Da'alif ne'mi'ata omeg. Oh, I remind myself I'm standing before someone with these traits, all these things. This is who I'm standing before. That's part of Chazal saying, make this real. You can't daven until you have some idea who you're talking to. That's what the Gemara means. La'olam yisader adam shivcho shomako. You have to first know who you're talking to. V'achar kach yitpalel. And then you can daven. But davening is a joke if you have no idea who you're talking to. The whole thing is ridiculous. It's not emes. It's not yikru'u v'emes. So what I'd like to do, we're going to start it just for a moment today. At the end, a little early. We start just for a moment today. I'd like to make the following proposition. That the introductory brachos of Shemoneh Esrei are there to tell us before whom we're standing. But that's why we have brachos. The one problem is, we have three brachos. Why are there three brachos? First of all, why are there three brachos anyway? I never thought about that. Why is the Shevach split up into three brachos? And why, if in fact, the first three brachos of Shemoneh Esrei are there to tell us what God is, Hashem Echad, Ushmo Echad, we know one thing about God, is that He's one. So, why are there three brachos? Do those three brachos say the same things about God? I would argue no way. The first three brachos of Shemoneh Esrei look at God in totally, totally, describing in totally different ways. This is where the multiple choice, everyone pick a path is going to begin to become clear. The first three brachos, we're challenged to know who before whom we stand. The first three brachos give us different pictures. Let's just look at the last of the three today. Ata kadosh v'shimcha kadosh u'kadoshim b'chol yom yahalelucha salim. Right? You have it here, if I'm not saying it right. Baruch Ata Hashem Hakel HaKadosh. There's a bracha with
one word repeated a lot of times. There's not very much in that bracha.
What? How does that bracha describe Hashem?
Don't say Kadosh.
How does that bracha... Oh, or you're allowed to use the word Kadosh, but then you have to explain it a little bit. How does that bracha describe Hashem? What are we saying about God in that bracha? Ataka, you are holy, and your name is holy, and holy things praise you every day. Blessed are you, the holy God. Well, clearly what we're saying about him is that he's holy, but what does that mean that he's holy? What is it? We're trying to clearly make one statement here. What are we saying about God in that bracha? What do we mean that he's holy? Come on, guys. You got to poke up a little more here. What are we saying? He's perfect. I don't know if that's exactly what holy means. It's true that he is. I'm not doubting that. So I'm not sure if that's what we're getting at. Yeah.
He's
different and separate. I like those two words. The fact that he's perfect is what makes him so much different from us, because we're clearly not. But he's different and he's separate. Now, what are you really saying about something when you're describing it as different and separate? You're kind of defining it by what it's not. It's a strange way of defining something. But what this bracha seems to be saying about God is, he's different from everything. The word kadosh really means separated, apart from, different. What this last bracha has to say about God is that whatever he is, he's different than whatever you think he is. He's removed. He's distant. That would explain, of course, did you ever wonder why this bracha is so much shorter than the other two? Because this bracha is basically describing Hashem as different. There's not very much to say. You are different. Even your name is different. Who can praise you? Kedoshim, even just to praise you, you have to be different. Blessed are you who are separate and different and special and perfect and all those other things that we can't really relate to. Okay? That's one way of describing God. Now let me just ask you one question before we conclude, and we'll continue with this next time. If the third bracha of Shemona Esrei describes God as being different, otherworldly, not like us, what am I doing when I'm davening here? What am I trying to do? How am I supposed to feel when I'm davening? Like, let's say we're making it real. Let's say that was our main goal, was to try to make tefillah something more meaningful, something real. What am I doing? What is the experience of tefillah if I just describe God as being otherworldly? What would it be? What's it like? I don't know, some of you, that may be the way you generally picture God. So what is the experience of davening like then? Well, God is already separate, so part of it is going to be feeling very separate, feeling very human, right? Feeling a little bit lost, right? Feeling that it's, right? Sometimes maybe even hard to talk to God, right? What else? What else is it going to feel like to daven? If he's so far away and I'm talking to him, what does that mean? What have I accomplished? I seem to have made some sort of a connection with him. Right? The experience of davening. If I just say that God is something very, very far away, the experience of davening to him is one of, wow, I made a connection. The call got through. Right? The same feeling that people have the first time they call Israel on a cell phone. They go, wow! Calling from cell phone, from your car, to someone who's in Eretz Yisrael. You can do this. Right? It's sort of a nice feeling, but it's sort of a feeling of almost amazement. If I've just defined God as being something very, very distant, then the experience of davening is trying to bridge a gap. when I daven, I should realize that in order to reach Him, I have to almost leave myself. I have to be something else. I have to uplift myself. We'll talk more about that a little bit next time. But let me just point out that this approach makes it the hardest to daven. Right? It means that davening is like, wow, it means that I have to actually connect to something which is kadosh, kadosh, kadosh. But it's also the one we're most comfortable with. Because in this way of viewing God, God is so distant that He doesn't scare us that much. He doesn't make us that uncomfortable. There are many times in our life where we'd rather think of God as being really out there. Now, that makes it a little challenging to daven if God is really out there, but at the same time, sometimes we like to pretend or we like to focus on the fact that God is kind of really out there. It makes it a little easier to be truthful. Because I don't even know how to define. Whatever it is, it's truthful. Whatever you are, wherever you are, I'm talking to you. You see that the first two brachos of Shemoneh Esrei take a very, very different, give us a different picture of the way we're supposed to relate to God. So we're going to have to look next time at those two approaches, and then we're going to have to deal with a fundamental question. Is Rabbi Penner truly a heretic? I mean, how can you say any of this stuff? I promise, I don't think I am. All this stuff is founded. But we'll have to see. There's a lot of as-if going on here. There's a lot of as-if going on. We're not really saying this, but we're talking about ways to relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay? I encourage you, if you're still looking for something more concrete, to give it another week or two. But we have to kind of introduce. And then we'll get more and more concrete as the weeks go on. Okay?